So when right after Leslie and I got married, I put on a lot of weight. Like, she's a good cook, getting married, drops her metabolism, I think. That's my hunch. And anyway, so after a couple of months, I don't know, like 6 months, I gained like 30 pounds. And it's one of those things that just kind of crept up on me. And then one day I looked at a picture of me pre-wedding, and it was like, you know, those P90X pictures of the before and after, except I was now the after picture, or I was the after picture before my wedding, and now I was the, you know what I'm saying, I'd gained weight. And anyway, so I, you know, started working out, and I started like trying to eat healthier, and I also started weighing myself every morning. That way, that would never happen to me again. It would never just sneak up on me. And so I've done that for years. For like 17 years, I've weighed myself every morning. But when we were moving from Abilene, Texas to Arkansas, we had to start eating a lot of fast food because all of our dishes were getting packed and all that stuff. And every morning when I would get on the scale, no matter what we ate, it said the same number. I was like, well, looks like that metabolism, I'm almost 40, but still, it's just going strong. And anyway, so then we move, and I have to put that scale in storage for a couple of weeks, and I step on another scale, and it gives me the wrong number. And I looked at it, and I thought, well, that's not right. You know what that is? That's fake news. That's what that is. So I went out and bought a scale, and I stepped on it, and it gave me the same wrong number. So I went out and bought another scale, and it gave me the same number. And I was like, maybe there's a problem with like magnets on the property or something. And then finally, I got my old scale out of storage, and I stepped on it, and it gave me that same familiar number, because that scale, I found out, had been broken for months. And I tell you all that to say, the problem wasn't the scale. The problem was that I didn't want to accept reality. So we're ending our little series today called Canoeing the Mountains. And I like that story to start with because the first task of leadership is to define reality. It does not do anyone any good to pretend like the scales are lying. It feels better for a season, but in our heart of hearts, we know it's the truth. And I really like the metaphor of canoeing the mountains because, and if you're a guest here, we've used this for the last few weeks because when Lewis and Clark, when the Louisiana Purchase happened, when they were first commissioned to go explore the western part of the United States, they took canoes with them. They were going to just canoe from, you know, the eastern part of the states all the way to the Pacific Ocean. And then all of a sudden, partway through their trip, they came upon the surprising discovery that made them realize their mission was going to fail because it was based on this giant faulty premise. They came upon the Rocky Mountains and they realized they had made a mistake because they had assumed that what was ahead of them was going to be like what was behind them. They had assumed something that just wasn't in line with reality. So you saw those numbers in the bumper video earlier. Every month, over 2,000 members leave our fellowship and 9 different churches close. In fact, when I first started this series just 4 weeks ago, on the very Sunday I started it, the Bauxite Church of Christ in Saline County announced it was closing its doors. I grew up driving past that church almost every day. I remember how many people they used to have. And now they're closed. We are 1.4 million as a movement, as a fellowship. We are at 1.4 million globally. And at the pace we're at in 30 years, today is my first day, it's Leslie's first day to pay on a 30-year mortgage. And by the time we pay that off, our fellowship at the current rate will be 250,000 people globally. Or as we began in this series, it would be basically this pew minus a few, or this row minus a few people. And those numbers aren't soft. They are relatively conservative. all signs point to the fact that the numbers might be worse than that. And that's why canoeing the mountains is a great metaphor for our time. And I like it. I'm telling you this not because I want to awaken in you a sense of despair, but a sense of urgency. And better than that, a sense of adventure. Because did you know they made it? Do you know that Lewis and Clark actually led their group all the way to the Pacific Ocean? They were ultimately able to adapt and grow and be successful. And so I think it's important for us to not pretend like those aren't Rocky Mountains in front of us. To be able to accept reality, because that not accepting reality doesn't help anybody. So the question for all of us is, in light of now of what we now know, what are we going to do with what we now know? There are a lot of options. One option is to say climbing the mountain is impossible and do nothing. By the way, that's the easiest option for the next few years. You will enjoy that option for the next few years. Or you can throw up your hands and join another fellowship. That is largely what the next generation is doing across the country right now. Or we can admit that the challenges in front of us are the obstacles in front of us are challenging. There are no easy answers, and we can gird our loins together and we can try to figure out how to climb this mountain. And to help bring clarity, as we close out this series, to help bring clarity, I want to tell you a Bible story today that if you grew up in church, no matter how long you've been in church, I bet you've never heard anyone preach on this particular story, but it is fascinating. So if you got your Bibles, turn to Isaiah chapter 38. This is just going to be setting up the Bible story that you've never heard anybody preach on. There's this one king in ancient Israel named Hezekiah, and after he's reigned for many years, the prophet Isaiah comes to Hezekiah and says, "You're going to die." This is a diagnosis from God. Now, some of you have had those kind of moments in your life where you've gotten news that the test results came back and it was bad, or it's, you know, you found a lump or whatever, or maybe somebody you love had those kind of test results. Maybe you've had some kind of worrisome symptom. I personally am a hypochondriac. Leslie says I've had the coronavirus twice already. We can't get on WebMD in my house because I can't, whatever symptom I read about, I start exhibiting within the next 12 hours. But this is more than just that. This is God telling someone, your time is up. God comes to Hezekiah through the prophet Isaiah and says, you're going to die. So that's the scene in chapter 38, starting in verse 1. In those days, Hezekiah became ill and was at the point of death. And the prophet Isaiah, son of Amoz, went to him and says, this is what the Lord says. Put your house in order, because you're going to die. You will not recover. Hezekiah turned his face to the wall and prayed to the Lord. Remember, Lord, how I have walked before you faithfully and with wholehearted devotion and have done what was good in your eyes. And Hezekiah wept bitterly. As he considers the end of his life, he begs God to do something. And this is one of those rare moments in the Bible where God changes his mind. God had told Hezekiah, you're going to die. And then God turns around and says, I've heard your prayer. And because of it, I'm going to add onto your life 15 years. And the rest of the chapter is Hezekiah thanking God and making all of these promises to God, thanking him for giving him extra life. So starting in verse 15, he says, but what can I say? He has spoken. God has spoken to me. He has done this himself. I will walk humbly all my years because of this anguish of my soul. Lord, by such things people live, and my spirit finds life in them too. You restored me to health and let me live. Surely it was for my benefit that I suffered such anguish. In your love, you kept me from the pit of destruction. You have put all my sins behind your back. For the grave cannot praise you. Death cannot sing your praise. Those who go down to the pit cannot hope for your faithfulness. The living, they praise you as I am doing today. Parents tell their children about your faithfulness. The Lord will save me, and we will sing with stringed instruments all the days of our lives in the temple of the Lord. In other words, here's what he's saying. I'm going to use every breath you give me for the next 15 years. Because you've spared my life, I am going to praise you. I'm going to be a parent that tells my children about the faithfulness that you have shown me. Can you imagine this scene? I mean, this is a Scrooge kind of on Christmas morning, giving his life back. This is, you know, Jimmy Stewart at the end of It's a Wonderful Life. By the way, I think David Tipton reminds me so much of Jimmy Stewart. Anyway, it's Jimmy at the end of It's a Wonderful Life, you know, welcome back, Bedford Falls. I've got a warrant for my arrest. Isn't it wonderful? I mean, it's that kind of moment. He's been given his life back. And by the way, if you are 50 or over, this is really all of us today. Because Hezekiah was probably 45, 50. The life expectancy has changed so much. Aren't you grateful just to be alive? And now the question for him, like for all of us, is what are you going to do with the life that you've been given? We know what he said he was going to do, but what did he actually do? And that brings us to today's story, starting in chapter 39, verse 1. At that time, Marduk-Baladan, son of Baladan, king of Babylon, sent Hezekiah letters and a gift because he had heard of his illness and recovery. Hezekiah received the envoys gladly and showed them what was in his storehouses, the silver and the gold and the spices and the fine olive oil, his entire armory and everything found among his treasures. There was nothing in his palace or in his kingdom that Hezekiah did not show them. Then Isaiah the prophet went to King Hezekiah and asked, "What did those men say and where did they come from?" "From a distant land," Hezekiah replied. "They came to me from Babylon." The prophet asked, "What did they see in your palace?" "They saw everything in my palace," Hezekiah said. "There is nothing among my treasures that I did not show them." So these envoys from Babylon come, and Hezekiah, who's pretty proud of everything he's king over, takes them and gives them a grand tour of everything. And then the prophet Isaiah, the same prophet who told them, "The word of the Lord says you're going to die," comes and he says, "Hey, Hezekiah, who were those guys you were showing around?" And he's like, "Don't worry, Hezekiah," or "Don't worry, Isaiah, those were my new friends from Babylon." And he goes, "What did you show them in your palace?" And he goes, "Isaiah, I showed them everything. Don't worry." They were super impressed by it. And then Isaiah says, "Because you have done this, here is the word of the Lord." In verse 5, "Then Isaiah said to Hezekiah, 'Hear the word of the Lord Almighty. The time will surely come when everything in your palace and all that your predecessors have stored up until this day will be carried off to Babylon. Nothing will be left, says the Lord. And some of your descendants, your own flesh and blood, who will be born to you, will be taken away, and they will become eunuchs in the palace of the king of Babylon. Because you did this, Hezekiah, you're going to lose everything. You're not just going to lose the stuff that you accomplished in your lifetime, but the stuff you inherited from your great-grandparents, all the stuff they accomplished, all the stuff they accrued. You're going to lose all of that. Because you did this, Hezekiah, your own family, your own sons and daughters are going to be taken into slavery and captivity in Babylon. And not just that, Hezekiah, your own sons are going to become eunuchs by force. No more grandkids, Hezekiah. I mean, can you imagine? This is the worst possible news ever, right? You're going to lose it all, your legacy, your future, your family. So what do you think Hezekiah's response was? When he found out he was going to die, he wept bitterly. He begged God. He made all these promises. So what's he going to do? Now, Hezekiah, now that you know the future, in light of what you now know, what are you going to do about the major problems that lie ahead for you and the people you love? What is his response to that? And it's here we begin to see where the people of God have so many problems. Because there's a little Hezekiah in all of us. Here's what he says. "The word of the Lord you have spoken is good," Hezekiah replied. For he thought, "There will be peace and security in my lifetime." The word of the Lord is good because there will be peace and security in my lifetime. In other words, yeah, that's pretty bad, but at least I won't be around to see it. The ship is going down, but it's not going down on my watch. Last month, there's a group of us from PV that went to Phoenix to an evangelism conference where people who were all over the country, from all over the country were there. People from every fellowship imaginable had gathered in Phoenix, and they were all from places in the country that were post-Christian already. Over 2,000 people came from places like Portland and Boston and Maine and Idaho, and we were the only church of any kind that was from Arkansas. And these people were talking about doing evangelism in places where people didn't know about like things like the Ten Commandments, in places where people didn't assume what the Bible said mattered about their own life. These were churches who had lived in post-Christian America for about a decade now. But what I want you to hear is that the primary emotion that the people at this conference had was not despair. It was hope. Because they were seeing the story of Jesus taking root in people's life who had no idea that Jesus was looking for them or Jesus was what they needed. And we left that conference feeling so inspired and excited about the future of PB. It started getting us thinking, we can do this. We can start reaching out in places like the UALR campus and in our workplaces and in our neighborhoods and schools. And at one point, Francis Chan was one of the speakers. He's a popular evangelical preacher. He is... He knows our fellowship. He spoke at the Tulsa workshop a few years ago. He really likes Churches of Christ. Francis Chan was a preacher. He started a church in San Francisco or in California, and then moved and started like a bunch of different kinds of churches in San Francisco and worked there for like decades. Francis Chan said when he lived in San Francisco, one of his favorite parts of living there was the foodie scene. Now, if you don't know what a foodie is, these are not people who like to get good food. These are the kinds of people who like to get the very best food. They really like the gourmet part of food. So Francis Chan was talking about how in San Francisco there was this group of people that knew where to go to get the best, you know, cupcake and the best cappuccino and the best Korean and the best Italian food. He loved this scene. He said he was a foodie. And then, a few years ago, Francis Chan said he and his family were called, they felt called by God to leave mission or ministry in the States and go do mission work in Hong Kong. And a few years ago, they were working in a refugee camp with a group of refugees, and all of a sudden, they heard this woman scream, this like blood-curdling scream. And they ran over, and there was this little boy laying on the ground, and that woman was laying over him, just screaming and sobbing. The little boy had died because the refugees didn't have enough food, because that country was in a famine. And in moments like that, refugees get the resources last. And Francis said, it is one thing to see pictures of a famine on the internet. It is an entirely different thing to hear a mother scream. And then he said, when I came back to San Francisco, it dawned on me, I didn't want to be a foodie anymore. It's really hard to... when you've heard a woman scream about the death of her child from lack of any kind of food, it's really hard to get too hyped about where the place is that gets you can get the best slice of pizza. And he said, that's when it dawned on me that that is the perfect metaphor for Christian churches in America. We are spiritual foodies. Think about the kind of questions we ask. Who's your favorite preacher? What place has the best worship? What podcast do you listen to? We are spiritual foodies in America, and we certainly have been in Churches of Christ. We have, for the last 100 years, had the luxury of splitting any time we disagreed on the most minute details. Someone just last week told me about the church, the city that they grew up in East Texas, the little town. They had 3 different Churches of Christ. One was the just kind of regular Church of Christ, whatever that means. The other one was a one-cup communion Church of Christ. And the other one was a one-cup communion that was hygiene conscious Church of Christ, which meant they brought their own straws every Sunday. I'd never heard of that. We've had that luxury in the past, and sadly, we have used it almost every chance we got over arguments that seemed really important at the time, but as the years passed and the smoke cleared, we realized they had a lot more to do with church and very little to do with Christ. And in many ways, what comes next is going to be a good thing. We will, by declining numbers, be forced to do exactly what we should have been doing all along. We will no longer be able to say, I will fellowship you if you believe in Jesus and X, Y, and Z on these debatable matters. We won't be able to do that anymore. Because what's ahead of us is not going to be like what was behind us. Those days are coming to an end. And in many ways, we should be thankful for that because the famine is coming. I started this little series with the story of Joseph telling the Egyptians that famine was coming. But before the famine, there was going to be 7 years of plenty. And I think that's a good metaphor. I used it when I was interviewing with this church, and I meant it. Because for the next couple of years, let me tell you what's going to happen. When those churches like Bauxite close, there's going to be a handful of people, and they're going to go somewhere. And they'll probably pick another Church of Christ. And the churches in the area will feel like a shot in the arm. For the next few years, they'll feel like, wow, we're doing something right. Even though it's just swelling from other churches closing their doors. And if you disagree with me on that assessment, I respect that, but I hope you can trust everything we're trying to do here is because we think that reality is coming to Central Arkansas. And right now, everything seems to be going okay. I get that. Okay, sure, our Christian college attendance is down. Our admissions are down. And Church of Christ attendance in Pulaski County has gone down quite a bit in the last 20 years. But maybe you can say, well, that's just a dip, not a trend. Okay, time will tell. But my hunch is, and again, I love us. I am not against us. I'm rooting for us. I hope I'm wrong. But across the country, the statistics don't improve. I'm telling you this not because I want to beat us down, but because I want us to realize there are mountains and we can climb them. Our first problem is going to be like the Egyptians. Our first problem isn't the famine. Our first problem is the complacency. I mean, the Egyptians, when they hear about this, they hear there are going to be 7 years of abundance. And for the next 7 years, if they don't do anything, it's going to feel great. Pharaoh would have been the most popular person in the world. They were going to have the opportunity to do nothing, and for a season, it would work. Better than work. It would appear like it was flourishing. But God tells them, but when the years of famine start, the years of abundance will not be remembered. And since this is pretty hard data, and since these are our friends and our kids and our grandkids, and for some of us people that aren't even born yet, I want to ask us one more time, are we comfortable serving what we want on our plates, knowing it might mean the next generation will starve? And to be clear, for a lot of people, that is what's happening. I know for a lot of us, the way we do things are fine, but generationally speaking, it's not. I told you 2 weeks ago, the Charles Seibert Institute, which has worked with hundreds and hundreds of churches across the country, of Churches of Christ, they have done, they've surveyed thousands and thousands of members of our fellowship, and they found that the big distinction, generationally speaking, the generations get together on a lot of stuff, what they like, what they appreciate about our tribe, but the one place where there is the broadest generational differences, and they've asked hundreds of questions to thousands of people, there are five questions, and four of them have to do with their experience when we worship together. And here it is. This is what they said. The number one distinct difference between generations, how they answer, is when I attend the corporate assembly, I'm filled with joy. In other words, if you are a senior saint, you answer that question very differently than a 20 or 30-something person. There's a 10-point differential on the statistics. Number two, participating in corporate worship encourages me to live a more Christ-like life. Number three, the singing during corporate worship is filled with life and vitality, which means one group of people says, yes, this is filled with life and vitality. And the other group of people says, no, this is not filled with life and vitality. Four, members of this church meaningfully participate in the singing. Those are the four biggest differences, generationally speaking, we have. And by the way, these are our own kids who are still in Churches of Christ. And part of the problem we're facing right now is it appears like, you know, adding a praise team is divisive. But let me promise you, that's the exact opposite of your elders' heart. They want grandparents to worship with grandkids and vice versa. I have been in rooms with these guys. I have watched them grieve over people they love. They don't want to hurt anybody, but they love this church too much to not allow us to prepare for what is ahead of us, because what is ahead of us is not like what is behind us. And what comes next is not going to be pretty if we keep pretending like everything's going along fine. Listen, worship, when you worship King Jesus, when we worship King Jesus together, the telltale marker for true worship is whether it is breaking barriers. It is an indicator, and this is not just true of our fellowship, this is true of all American Christianity and churches. For the most part, people worship with people like them. Worship doesn't break barriers. We're talking about breaking barriers like racially and generationally and educationally. And I know that's hard, but if we want to be pass something on to the next generation, if we want to be good news for the city of Little Rock, isn't it worth it? I think about the way Americans sacrificed during World War II. It was sacrifice. It took a lot, but the cause was worth it. I think about how last year I watched this church when we had a team of people who went on a short-term mission trip to Haiti, and when they got stranded, when the country was in unrest, I watched this church sacrifice so much. I watched us come together because suddenly we had a cause, and it was worth whatever it took. I hope that's what this little series has done. I want us to face reality. I am not trying to be a doomsday person. And by the way, just so you know, in the Bible, false prophets were mainly the people who said everything's going to be fine when it wasn't. I want us to face reality squarely. I want to awaken a sense of adventure and urgency with us. I'm grateful for Brother Joel's comments. I didn't know he was going to say that nice stuff about me and Josh. But listen, this is not about me and Josh. I'm just a preacher. This is not even about our leadership. If this is going to happen, it's going to take all of us. You know, most churches wouldn't, because churches are made of people. And most people wouldn't. Even if we all agreed we're in an adapt or die or even adventure or die moment, most people wouldn't. Did you know that when doctors, some of y'all are doctors, when doctors sit down people who have had heart attacks or they're about to have heart transplants or, you know, quadruple bypasses, when they sit them down after the surgery and they tell them, if you don't stop drinking, if you don't stop smoking, if you don't stop eating bacon or whatever it is, you will die. Did you know that 90% of people who are given that kind of change or die news, 90% of them within 2 years go back to the same behavior? They choose to risk death. In a world where we have technology to do heart bypasses and heart transplants, we continually fail to get people to change the behavior that make those procedures necessary. But I believe this church can do it. You know why? Because you said you could. The week after we made an announcement about adding a worship team, we took the church survey about how we were doing regarding generational generosity. And by the way, that wasn't planned. That was when we needed to do it. And this church filled out this survey, the Growing Young is what the program is called. Around 350 people, almost 350 people took it, and the majority of us who took it were over 50 and had been here between 11 and 50 years. And here's what you said about us as a church. You said this is a place where there's a strong sense of community. Hundreds of us answered that this is true, that this is a community that you trust. You said that we do a good job of being actively involved in our neighborhood and have a reputation for being a caring neighbor for people around here. You said we know we need to get better at helping newcomers be integrated. You said we know we need to help get better at making visitors feel welcome. You said we know we need to get better at recognizing the problems young people face. You said, hundreds of us said, we need to make efforts to put ourselves in the shoes of young people. We said together, we need to be men and women who go out of our way to understand the perspectives of young people. And then hundreds of us said, it was moderately true to very true that we have people who are willing to contribute to making changes. And then hundreds of us said, it was very true that we're open to making changes to strengthen our ministry with young people. And then hundreds of you said, we have key leaders who are willing to make changes when necessary. I'm asking us today to be the church we said we are. But what I'm really asking is for you to outlive your life. It's true. Those numbers are drastic. And they're pretty, I think they're right. But for some of you, you have the option to say, I'm not going to be around in 2050. You can pay off your mortgage on your own. There may be peace and security in your lifetime, and you may not have to live to see the famine. So you can take comfort in not having to prepare for it. But how many little boys do you know named Hezekiah today? When we were doing this survey in the TAP class, the 20s and professional class, people wrote in adults that meant a lot to them. And it was names like Jim Wood and Cindy Rowe and David Beggs. And I know for some of us this is uncomfortable, but you want this. We want this. Don't you want to pass on something to the next generation? And I promise you, if you are generationally generous today, we will honor you. I'll honor you. This church will honor you every chance we get because your kids and your grandkids are watching. You know the most inspiring character of this whole Lewis and Clark thing to me? He didn't even go on the trip. You know who it was? The most inspiring character didn't go on the trip, but he imagined it in the first place. It was the person who commissioned Meriwether Lewis. Anybody know who that was? Thomas Jefferson. Way to go, history people. He was president and he was over 60 years old. He was the senior citizen who changed the world. You know what he did? He went to a 29-year-old Lewis and said, I want you to go west. Jefferson had never traveled more than 50 miles west of his hometown in his life. But because he rolled the dice on that team, we now know about the Western world. Thomas Jefferson never saw the Grand Canyon. He never saw the view from Lemley Pass. He never saw the Great Falls. But he was the one who had the vision for the adventure and gave the captains their charge. That's what I hope this little series has done for us. I want it to awaken a sense of adventure in us. Because the world is changing and we can wish it's not true. We can pretend like the scales are lying, or we can wake up to the mission and adventure of God. I want us to be the Church of Christ Columbuses of Central Arkansas. I mean that in the best possible way. So this reality doesn't have to be the reality. Because without that sense of adventure and mission, you know what? Without Columbus, the world would never have known you could go east by sailing west. And you can live that kind of life. We can live that kind of life. Together we can face the truth that what's ahead of us is not going to be like what is behind us. And we can live lives together that send echoes into eternity. You can trust God to take the seeds of the gospel you plant with your life and make it bloom. You can outlive your life. May we all be so lucky.